So the fifth and final series of these clips, I want to think a little bit about 1917 itself. Now, it should go without saying, as indeed it should for all of the clips that I've presented so far, that these are summaries of enormously complicated historical events. Indeed, 10 to 15 minutes are not enough, but many, many hours would not be enough to contain all of the events that occur in 1917, a year of enormous complexity. Just to give you some of the brief highlights then in this clip, thinking in connection to some of those issues that I mentioned in the last clip on the war, it's the war of 1914-17. So on the 23rd of February 1917, International Women's Day, thousands of women textile workers and housewives took to the streets of Petrograd to protest at a bread shortage. Again here we have a food crisis and deprivation being really important to what occurs. This was an enormous demonstration, one that was largely spontaneous in character. In fact, it's the start of a political process that will lead to the abdication of the Tsar, which is something that not many people at the time had expected. By the following day, there were around 200,000 strikers taking symbolic control of the capital. Students and members of the middle classes joined the crowd soon after in late February, many of them bearing red flags and singing the Marseillaise. Among the banners were emblazoned with words like "Down with the war," "Down with the Tsarist government." Some of the other banners of February had demands to feed children or provide food to the family of soldiers. Soon afterwards, many thousands of soldiers joined the insurgents. There was great iconoclasm here, destroying emblems of slavery, the old regime, destroying things like the two-headed eagle, the symbol of the Romanov dynasty, and the arresting of Tsarist officials. The revolution, it seemed, was in progress, but it wasn't clear at this point where the revolution would lead. At this point, the Duma starts to take charge. Liberal members of the Duma create a deputy, chaired by the Octoberist deputy, Mikhail Rodzianko, which plays a role in determining the course of events. This committee sets about arresting ministers, generals and police chiefs, and also persuading some of the regiment's commanders to side with the revolution. Rodzianko uses influence to get the Stavka, the Russian high command in the military, on side in order to persuade the Tsar to abdicate. The February Revolution gave to a short-lived mood of euphoria and national unity. Overnight, there were massive changes in political discourse. Far from being subjects, people were now considered citizens by many of the revolutionaries. In terms of the political settlement, it most famously gives rise to dual power. This is the creation of provisional government, a government headed by Prince Georgi Lvov. The government on the 2nd of March pledged a programme of far-reaching civil and political rights and to convoke what they called a constituent assembly. Very important issues the government had to think about were the issues of war, which at this point was still ongoing, and also land for the people. On the other hand, the other part of this dual power is the Petrograd Soviet, an enormously important entity which controlled the army, transport, communications. Within a week, around 1,200 deputies were elected to the Petrograd Soviet, and the number soon rose to around 3,000. Significantly, Alexander Kerensky, who had played an important role in the events that year, was the only deputy from the Petrograd Soviet to join the government itself. The February Revolution produced a surge of patriotism and renewed determination against a wide chunk of society. Intriguingly, this was actually to defend the revolution against German militarism. So the question of war was still ongoing at this point, and the question of how to deal with Russia's allies. Outside of the capital, the situation looked rather different. Indeed, dual power didn't really exist. Much as I mentioned in the last clip, Russia's an enormous entity, a very complicated one in terms of its social, ethnic and religious and so on makeup. It wasn't always clear that people would be able to be keyed into these processes of dual power that are being made in the major cities. During the spring of 1917, many more Soviets spring up. These played an important role in what was to come. The trade union movement, which had been suppressed, was revived. By October 1917, it boasted around 2 million members, and the appearance of the Soviets' workers' councils occurred exponentially throughout the year. 700 appeared during March and April, and by the summer they embraced around 200,000 deputies, an enormous number of people. The first All-Russian Congress of Soviets was at the beginning of June. Out of 822 voting delegates, 285 were SRs, Social Revolutionaries, 248 were Mensheviks, 32 were Menshevik internationalists and 105 were Bolsheviks. So you can see then there's great disparity amongst the left of who's elected to these. In fact, in mid-1917, the largest of all the political parties in terms of their membership was indeed the SRs, the Socialist Revolutionary Party. However, they were fraught with infighting and indeed split later in that year. into left and right factions. Of course, at this point, it's very important to mention the impact of the Bolsheviks, and of course Lenin himself, who would play a key role in the events that were to come. The war was still ongoing up February 1917, and frequent ministerial changes occurred in official government throughout this year. Peasant land hunger was still an enormous problem, and many people in Russia were impatient. The provisional government had advanced plans for land reform and a convocation of constituent assembly, part of its wider desires to increase political representation. In the 3rd of April of 1917, Lenin returns after 16 years in exile. The left-wing Menshevik Nikolai Sukarnov described his arrival at the Finland station in Petrograd, St. Petersburg, as follows. He wore a round cap, his face looked frozen, and has a magnificent bouquet in his hands. Lenin stood there as though nothing taking place had the slightest connection with him, looking about him, and then turning away from the executive committee delegation altogether, he made this reply. Dear comrades, the piratical imperialist war is the beginning of the civil war throughout Europe. The hour is not far distant when the people will turn their arms against their own capitalist exploiters. The worldwide socialist revolution has already dawned. Now, it's important at this point to stress that Bolshevism was much broader than just the views of its leader, and Lenin really only represents one particular strand. But it's important also to stress Lenin was the figure in the party even at this stage, and he stamped his views on it. He had enormous intellectual abilities, he had tremendous industry, he was extremely self-disciplined and confident, and in addition to all of that, he was incredibly intolerant of all sorts of political opponents. So Lenin's plans played a great role in what was to come. He sought an immediate end to what he called the imperialist war, and he called for an end to what he termed revolutionary defensism. On the 3rd of July 1917, something very famous happens, the so-called July Days. This is a very important part of 1917. Troops from the Kronstadt naval base and Bolshevik actives are fired upon by loyalist troops. This is an insurrection led by Lenin, which was also actually crossed by Kerensky, who orders, in his terms, severe retribution against those involved in the rising. After the insurrection is quashed, Lenin flees to Finland, and it looks as though Kerensky's won. If you were to teleport into this period in time, you might actually think the rise of the Bolsheviks and Lenin towards the end of that year is perhaps not foreordained at all. After the July Days, Kerensky becomes Prime Minister. On the 19th of July, he appoints General L.G. Kornilov as Commander-in-Chief of the Russian Army. This is an appointment designed to save Russia from anarchy and to show Kerensky himself as a strong leader. But on the 26th of August, Kerensky lashes out after receiving an ultimatum, which asks that military and civil authority be placed in the hands of the Supreme Commander. This is something that becomes known as the Kornilov Affair. Kerensky accuses Kornilov of conspiring to overthrow the government. Kornilov is then relieved of his duties, but appears to ignore the commands and advances on Petrograd. This is something that's very controversial in the scholarship, and historians dispute whether Kornilov was conspiring to overthrow the government or not. Kerensky needed to call in the Soviets to stop Kornilov, showing at this point his reliance on the Soviets as important bodies in the country. We should also think at this time of the wider situation that's occurring. The key issues for the peasantry, the vast majority of people in the country, had remained the land question, but also the war. The food became an enormous problem. Much of the harvest was now being sold on the market. The government tried to respond by introducing a state monopoly on grain, but its attempts to force peasants to sell the grain at prices provoked them to conceal stocks or turn it into alcohol. An enormous food crisis was now looming, especially in Petrograd. Therefore, you have more widely in the country a real problem, a real crisis brewing. But you've also got in the leadership itself, you've got great political change, and also political valences changing very, very rapidly.